This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Mack Weldon. So if you're like most men, you've probably been wearing the same brand of underwear since you were 17 years old. There's been a lot of changes in that time frame. And Mack Weldon is one of the companies that have been on the forefront in improving underwear. Their design, their boxer brief, that doesn't ride up your legs. You're never having to have to adjust yourself. All their undergarments are made from antimicrobial fabrics, which means it eliminates odor. If you want to try Mack Weldon out at a discount, I've got an offer for you. Go to mackweldon.com and use promo code AOM at checkout for 20% off. Again, mackweldon.com, promo code AOM for 20% off. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. If you're a Tolkien fan, you know, Lord of the Rings, Hobbit, or you're a C.S. Lewis fan, you probably have heard of the Inklings. If you haven't heard of the Inklings, you're in for a treat. This was a literary group that both Tolkien and Lewis belonged to for over three decades at Oxford, where they got together one night a week to discuss and critique each other's work, but as well as talk about philosophy, religion, myths, et cetera, while smoking pipes and drinking adult beverages. It was like a little men's group. It was only men, all men. Anyways, my guests today on the podcast have written a biography of this group. It's called The Fellowship, The Literary Lives of the Inklings. Their names are Philip and Carol Zaleski. They're a married couple. And today on the show, we're going to discuss the members of the Inklings, Tolkien, Lewis, also some of the more lesser known individuals, but also who had a profound impact on American literature in other ways, Owen Barfield and Charles Williams. And we'll also discuss the lasting impact of the Inklings on a religion in the West, as well as literature in the West. Great discussion. So without further ado, Philip and Carol Zaleski. Philip and Carol Zaleski, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brett.
So you two are a husband-wife team, wrote a book about the Inklings. Now, I know a lot of our listeners know who the Inklings are, have heard of them, and are big fans of two of the members. But for those who aren't familiar, can you tell us what were the Inklings and who belonged to this little group?
You want to dive in, Carol? Or
okay. Yeah. We're in different rooms, so we can't signal to each other. But I'd be happy to start out on that. So the Inklings, was a literary club, a fellowship is how we like to think of it. Which is perhaps runs a little deeper than the affiliations you might have in a club. And it was founded not by Tolkien and Lewis themselves, but by an undergraduate named Edward Tangi Lean, brother of the filmmaker David Lean at Oxford. But Tolkien and Lewis and a few other like-minded friends had been gathering since the late 1920s for literary conversation. They took over from the group called the Inklings that was founded by Edward Tangi Lean late in 1933, and they used to meet in C.S. Lewis's rooms in Magdalen College on Thursday evenings to read their works in progress to each other, and then socially they would meet in various pubs on Tuesday mornings, most likely, and that went on until Lewis died on the same day as JFK in 1963. So it was about 30 years of gatherings with a variety of people joining.
Right. So it was a literary group. And then, yeah, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, everyone knows a lot of people know who they are. Mm-hmm. You've seen Lord of the Rings. You guys know who Tolkien is. But you started off the book talking about sort of the atmosphere at Oxford. I thought this was really interesting. I didn't know much about this, but there was this real culture of club creation. It seemed like there was a club for almost anything and everything at Oxford at the time. And the members of the Inklings belonged to other clubs, not just the Inklings. Can you tell us a little bit about this culture of creating clubs and what kind of clubs people could find at Oxford during the early part of the 20th century?
Yeah, well, as you say, the clubs were innumerable, and both Tolkien and Lewis were avid members of many clubs. I think I'd start by pointing out that this goes back to Tolkien's teenage years when he formed a club called the Tea Club and Barovian Society, devoted to he and his friends, so three or four close friends, had decided to j- formed this club to bring goodness and honesty and virtue and purity to Western civilization. So Tolkien at a very early age was club oriented. Lewis dove in when he went to Oxford. Clubs that they belonged to included, Lewis belonged to an English faculty club called The Cave. Tolkien belonged to, I wonder if I can remember the name, something called the Checkers Club, I think.
He founded that one, yeah.
Yeah. He joined the Debating Society, a club called the Dialectical Society. So there were all sorts of clubs. Eventually, he and Tolkien, when they first became friends, formed a club called the Coal Biters, which literally means men biting coal. And it's a reference to ancient Icelandic bards. And this was a society devoted to Norse mythology and Norse literature. And then it all blossomed in the Inklings itself. And while they were writing the great works, they also belonged to other clubs.
I think just to underscore what Phil was saying about the ubiquity of clubs at Oxford, there's also a long tradition of that just in English culture. And we talked about that in the book, that there were forerunners to these clubs. There's a club that called the Friday Street Club that Ben Jonson and John Donne belonged to. Keats even dedicated a poem to it. And there was the Scriblerus Club that had Jonathan Swift and Alexander Pope. And we really were drawn to the club, which was founded by Samuel Johnson and the painter Sir Joshua Reynolds, and had an amazing group of men. Edmund Burke was in it, Adam Smith, Asiatic Jones. And it was similar in many ways to the Inklings. That is, there's no platform for the club. It's just a place to go and hang out with like-minded people.
Right, so, I mean, it sounds like the Inklings was a legacy of Enlightenment. Because the way you described it, it sounded very much like, Benjamin Franklin starting the Mutual Improvement Societies here.
Yeah. And in fact, C.S. Lewis is often compared to Samuel Johnson, who is the great Enlightenment figure in English history.
Okay. And does this club culture still exist at Oxford?
You know, I looked at the Oxford University website. There's a long, long list of clubs and societies and debating groups which have official sanction, but in that respect, they're not private clubs. I think that the era of the private men's club has faded. I think maybe because it may seem to some people elitist or exclusive, or that a kind of multicultural and co-ed environment seems to make it look like a thing of the past. Right. I'm not sure that, I mean, I don't think it's entirely a thing of the past, but I think that makes inroads into club culture.
Right, and that was interesting too about the Inklings. They had a very strict no women rule.
I think that's almost unstated. It's just an assumption that these would be sex segregated clubs. There was, stories to circulate about Dorothy L. Sayers trying to get into the club and banging on the door and not being let in, but that's apocryphal.
So I know most people who are listening are probably familiar with C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, but there's two other members of the Inklings that you highlight and go into great detail about their biographies: Owen Barfield and Charles Williams. And honestly, before I read, but can you tell us a little bit about their influence on, I guess, English literature or academics at Oxford?
Well, sure. I'd say Charles Williams is by far the better known of the two, because he was a novelist who published quite a number of what people refer to as supernatural shockers. These are thrillers. Or mystery novels, or then always involve supernatural events. They were quite popular at the time, and they're still popular. There are many avid Williams fans around these days. Williams was a
in a way, a self-taught man. He worked at Oxford University Press most of his adult life, became a well-known editor there, and befriended Lewis and then the other Inklings. In addition to his spiritual shockers, he wrote some marvelous books on Dante and on Anglican history and on poetry. He considered himself a poet first and foremost. Barfield is a more obscure figure. He was a specialist in the history of language, in the history of words, and how words change over the centuries. And he had this really brilliant idea, which amounts to the reverse engineering of words, where you track the history of words back in time until you get to their primordial meaning. And through this, he thought he could trace the history of human consciousness as well. So as you can imagine, his books are a little more abstruse, obscure, and even occult than Williams are. But he also has a somewhat of a following, some very important people. Saul Bellow, the Nobel Prize winner, most notably, have been students of his or disciples of his. So these are the two most prominent Inklings apart from Lewis and Tolkien, and that's why we chose to focus on them as well. Yeah,
and I guess Barfield, I thought it was interesting. Like, he seemed like his entire life, he was sort of, envious maybe, but a little envious of the success. It wasn't until later on in life that he actually had some renown and some success. He experienced that.
Yeah, it makes for a beautiful story in a way, because it's a great tale of someone who is in the shadows for most of his life. A Barfield didn't have great skills as a fiction writer, couldn't make a living as a writer. You can hardly make a living as a writer of the historian of language. So he went into the law. And while Tolkien and Lewis and many of the other Inklings were basking in public acclaim, poor Barfield was toiling away in his London law office, you know, dealing with real estate matters and torts and so on. But eventually, in the 1960s, people started reading his books, mostly at first because he was known as C.S. Lewis's best friend. And he came to America, Barfield did, and started giving lecture tours around America and teaching at American universities. And these were a smash success, both the teaching and the lecture tours. And people then started reading Barfield's own books, and they discovered that in addition to being Lewis's great friend, Barfield himself had very intriguing ideas to offer. And ideas that fit in rather well with the tenor of the 1960s and 1970s, because he was an esoteric thinker. He was interested in alternative descriptions of history. He rejected Darwinism, for example. He was a follower of a German spiritual teacher named Rudolf Steiner. So Barfield came into his own just when the other Inklings were dying out. And in fact, he lived to be 99 years old, so he had a chance to savor his late triumph.
Yeah, it was great to see. Like, it kind of worked out for him in the end.
Yeah.
I'm curious. So you mentioned that there were other members of the group. Like, these were the four most prominent, Lewis, Tolkien, Barfield, and Williams. But it seemed like also the membership of the Inklings was very fluid.
There was the critic and biographer, Lord David Cecil, an immensely attractive figure, an important man of letters, who also had ties to the Bloomsbury Group, which had a very different literary and cultural mindset. But he was that sort of a generous mind that he could live in both worlds. There was an important Chaucer scholar and theater and film director, Neville Coghill, who actually gave Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor their start in Oxford theatrics. And there was a Dominican named Gervais Matthew, scholar, and an English don named Hugo Dyson, very rambunctious fellow. There was also Lewis's brother, Warney, who presided at Inkling's meetings, poured the drinks. Actually, he himself struggled with alcoholism, but he was a very kind man. And he also wrote, histories of 17th century France. And then a young member was John Wayne, who later became known as one of the group called the Angry Young Men.
Yeah, and didn't also Tolkien's son join as well?
And Tolkien's son, right.
Yeah, who's still alive and is the last living Inkling.
I'm curious. So they had all these members that would come and join, but it seemed like these four were like the core. I'm curious, like what drew these men together? Because it seems like they come from very different backgrounds, right? You have Tolkien the Catholic with Lewis the atheist turned Anglican. You have Barfield who was really into esotericism and you had Williams who was a poet. I mean, what was it that drew these men? What was the common bond between all of them?
Well, there are several common bonds. First of all, perhaps first and most importantly, they were all writers, and not only writers, but very active and productive writers. The Inklings group really was a writing club. They write each other's unpublished manuscripts, works in progress, and then they severely criticized each other's works. And this criticism improved the works of all the members. So that's something they had in common. In addition, they were all Christians. Lewis said explicitly to Charles Williams that being a Christian was a requirement for joining the group. They were romantics, pretty much to a man. They loved language. They loved stories. They loved fantasy, which set them off from the accepted literary views of the day, and that's something that united them. They were united then in adversity as well as in comradeship.
I'm curious.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, Karen. Also I would add anti-modernism to that, or not in a reactionary anti-modernism, but a desire to see the world re-enchanted through its connection to traditions and values of the past.
Yeah, that was really interesting, particularly when you talk about C.S. Lewis and his literature. Because he wrote sci-fi. A lot of people don't know that, or they forget that.
It really was science fantasy more than science fiction. It was a way for him to present mythological and spiritual ideas on a broader canvas. He set them on other planets, but I don't think they would be considered anything like hardcore science fiction.
Right. But but is that theme of like they were sort of anti-modern, but they wanted to recapture, I guess, some of the essence of it?
Yeah, that's how we look at it. It's an effort at what we call recovery rather than reaction. So recovery really brings into the present what is worth saving from the past and what is still a living tradition. So it's not it's not antiquarianism and it's not mere nostalgia, but it's a sense that there's a real live tradition that perhaps we're in a state of amnesia. We've forgotten that it's there, but it's still viable for us. And that's one thing that Owen Barfield helped with, actually. He convinced Lewis that the ideas of the past can be, I guess, evaluated on their own merits, and that it's only chronological snobbery that makes us think that ideas that were life-giving in the past are no longer available to us.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. All right, so you probably start your day off with a caffeinated beverage of some sort, probably coffee, maybe an energy drink, whatever. Well, why not include caffeine in your shaving ritual as well? Yes, there is a company out there called Pacific Shaving Company, and they've introduced a line of caffeinated shaving products. And what this does, it doesn't give you energy, right, through your skin. What caffeine does on your skin is that it acts as a vasoconstrictor, which means that it constricts blood vessels underneath your skin and diminishes the appearance of redness. So it's a great way to diminish or treat razor burn that you get with shaving. So caffeine is high in antioxidants, so you can leave your skin looking nice and young and rejuvenated. Makes a great lather, comfortable shave. I've tried it out. If you want to try Pacific Shaving Company, their line of caffeinated shaving cream. Go to pacificshaving.com/manliness, and you can get a great deal for $10. You'll get shaving cream and caffeinated aftershave, no shipping, no handling, just $10. So again, pacificshaving.com/manliness. Also by Spreza Box. So a lot of things you wear when you dress up, things like socks, ties, tie bars, things like that, they are marked up incredibly high at retail. So you spend a lot of money on it. And the problem with those things too, if you want to find the one that you like, you have to go to all sorts of websites and, like, you know, roam department stores to find the thing you want. Well, there's a company out there called Spreza Box that solves both of these problems. It's a monthly box subscription service. You sign up once a month. They're going to send you a box containing 5 to 6 products that things like ties, socks, cufflinks, sunglasses, shave products, more. Boxes are $25 a month, and the items in there are going to be guaranteed at have a retail value of $100 or more. So it's a great way to save some money, but also get discover some new products for your wardrobe. So if you want to try this out at a discount, I got an offer for you. Go to sprezabox.com and use the discount code manliness at checkout to get 20% off your first month's box. Again, that's sprezabox.com, discount code manliness for 20% off your first month's box. Great. Phil, you alluded a little bit to the dynamic. It was a writing club. They'd come to each other. Someone would read a work. There was criticism. I mean, do we know what a typical meeting was like, or like the dynamic in a meeting? Do we have records of that?
Yeah, we have diary entries by mostly by Lewis's brother, Warney Lewis, who near the end of his life lamented several times that he hadn't kept careful notes. I think he said if he realized that what he had, what he'd been a part of, he would have recorded every meeting in detail. Instead, we just have brief accounts of meetings, but we have many of those. And we know that meetings would start, well, these were evening meetings for the most part, at least the ones in Lewis's digs at Magdalen College, which were the more important meetings. Those are the ones in which literary work actually went on. The Tuesday morning meetings were more just general socializing. So they would all gather in the evenings, and Warney would take coats and would settle members down with a drink. And then C.S. Lewis would ask if anyone had something to read. And generally someone did, and it would be read. And then the comments would start. They also discussed ideas, all manner of ideas, whether dogs go to heaven, the nature of hell. You know, if I had Warney's diaries in front of me, I could tell you about 30 or 40 amusing things they discussed. There was a lot of friendship, a lot of rivalry, a lot of caustic comments, especially by Hugo Dyson, who could be very funny, but also could be very nasty in his reflections on other people's works and ideas. But there was a lot of laughter. I think the group lasted so long because people really enjoyed the meetings. They enjoyed laughing with each other, telling stories, drinking together, just having a good time together.
And so, I mean, when they did offer criticism, like, did they really go after the person? Was it like gloves off? I mean, I think nowadays when people have like reading, like, you know, writers groups, like everyone's like, everyone wants to be really polite, but I imagine that's not what happened here.
No, they weren't really polite. Sometimes they could be, well, Hugo Dyson could be quite vulgar, but I'll refrain from repeating what he said about Tolkien's elves. Tolkien, for his part, could be quite critical of Lewis because he felt that Lewis was trying to write the kind of mythopoeic imaginative literature that Tolkien himself was dedicated to, but that Lewis was kind of slipshod about it and didn't really work at building out a completely internally coherent mythos when he was creating imaginary worlds. And Tolkien had very high standards about that. No one ever before or ever since Tolkien has accomplished what he did in terms of internally consistent, believable, invented mythologies. So he would criticize Lewis for that. But another thing they did for each other, though, was encouragement. I mean, when in terms of outsiders, they would circle the wagon. So they could be quite critical of one another. But for instance, when Lewis tried to get his first science fiction fantasy novel published, Out of the Silent Planet, The readers' reports were pretty bad, and the publisher was pretty negative about it until Tolkien intervened on Lewis's behalf and praised it to the hilt, even though privately with Lewis he had had some serious criticisms of it. But again, when they're against the world, or against the modernist literary establishment, or simply trying to get their work out there and get it appreciated, they would review each other's works, and they would write to publishers and intercede for one another.
Yeah, this encouragement, in fact, that they offered each other was especially important for Tolkien, who's always very hesitant about exposing his great mythology to the public, and who always had doubts about Lord of the Rings, which took him an eternity to write. And if without Lewis's constant encouragement and goading, we wouldn't have the Lord of the Rings today. And thanks to Lewis, we do.
Yeah, I was surprised how long it took him to write that. I mean, it just seemed like decades he was working on it.
Yeah.
Well, the problem was that it started out to be, it was meant to be a sequel to The Hobbit. The Hobbit had been a book that he had written without great agony because it started with just telling stories to his kids. That came naturally. But he had been working since he was a young man in the trenches in the First World War. He'd been working on a private mythology and invented languages to go with it. And that's what he really wanted to publish. But instead, the publishers were interested in, you know, the new Hobbit novel, the Hobbit sequel. So he's trying to write the Hobbit sequel, but the mythology keeps working its way into that. And it was very hard for him to integrate these two dramatically different kinds of creative work. In The Lord of the Rings, you can see some of the strains, the sort of places where it didn't knit together perfectly.
You mentioned that, you know, he was working on this during World War One. That's another thing that all these men had in common, or for most of them, they all served during World War One. Did that common bond like serve as some like a way to foster some camaraderie between all of them?
Well, it was tremendously important. In fact, we in our book, The Fellowship, we look at all these writers, most especially Lewis and Tolkien, as war writers. Sure, they were fantasists, but they were also war writers. All of them wrote about war in their fiction. And it's ever-present in Lord of the Rings. You can't understand Lord of the Rings without knowing about Tolkien's experience in the war. And sure, they shared it with the other Inklings. Some of the younger ones only experienced World War II, I suppose. That was certainly true of Christopher Tolkien. But they all had war experience, or most of them had war experience. Even the ones who didn't get to actively fight, like Williams and Barfield, played a part in the war somehow.
Yeah, and I think the question you raised earlier about the maleness of this club, I think of interest to your readers and listeners, I think that has a lot to do with it. Tolkien wrote that by 1918, all but one of his close friends had died. These men experienced both the male camaraderie and bonding of the war and the severe loss of having friends fall to the left and to the right and to the front and to the back of them during the war. So when they returned from the war, they had every reason to prize male fellowship. It was a precious and a precarious and a very, you know, damaged gift.
Yeah, I think I remember there's a line where Lewis talks about, I guess that sort of him relishing male camaraderie. He says one of the best sounds in the world is like the sound of male laughter.
Yeah, his favorite sound, adult male laughter.
Adult male laughter.
And that is a great sound.
It is, because you don't hear it all that often.
I teach at a women's college, and I try to present that in a way that my students will be sympathetic to it, and they generally are, because that is a special thing.
You really don't hear it all that often, because it's very rare where men, older men, adult men who are married, get together and have a good time.
Yeah, of course, it's a good way to escape from the domestic situation, too.
So let's talk a little more about Lewis and Tolkien, because I think their relationship is really interesting. Because as I read the book, it seemed that it ebbed and flowed throughout the years, and that there was a bit of strain there between the two. I got the impression that the strain was because both of these men had high expectations on what friendship meant. Can you talk a little bit about how each man viewed friendship and the role it should play in a person, or particularly a man's life?
You want to tackle that, girl?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, Lewis, you know, wrote a book called The Four Loves, in which one of the loves he talks about is friendship. And in that book and in other places, too, he's the one that kind of articulated a theory of friendship, which is that especially male friendship, what characteristic of it is that they're not really focused on each other. They're focused on a common interest, a common ideal. And you can see this in Tolkien's teenage friendship that Phil was talking about, the Tea Club and Barovian Society. They were really dedicated to something beyond themselves. And so dedicated as they were to shared ideals outside of simply their own personalities, they could still have friction that is the result of differences in their personalities. And, you know, when women come into the picture, it's kind of like Yoko Ono breaking up the Beatles, you know, or not well, causing tensions. They had very different life situations. Tolkien was very uncomfortable when Lewis got together with this divorcee, Joy Davidman. Didn't approve of that relationship. There were a number of things Lewis did that Tolkien didn't approve of. They had religious differences too. Tolkien felt that Lewis never totally overcame his anti-Catholicism from his Belfast background.
But still, the friendship was sustained over the decades, ebbing and flowing, as you said, but it was sustained. It's interesting to look at The Lord of the Rings in this with this in mind. Because The Lord of the Rings, as well as being a war tale, is also a tale of friendship, of course. And in fact, a friendship not only among people who had different religious views, but people of different species, elves, yeah. hobbits, dwarves, and human beings. And they had tensions, as we know from the book and from the films, simply by their species differences. But nonetheless, the fellowship remained. And I think that's, in a way, an account of the Inklings as well.
Yeah. And I'm curious, like, what do you think their legacy is? I mean, I think we all know, like, their literary legacy for C.S. Lewis or Tolkien. Like, where do we still see, like, that was because of it wasn't because of the individual. It was like, we can look at something either in Christianity or in literature, and we can say, it wasn't just Tolkien that had that influence. It wasn't just Lewis. It was like, it was the dynamic of the group that had that influence. Like, if it weren't for the group, that would not have happened. Is there anything that you all can point to?
Well, I think that in certain ways, they had different sectors of influence. So Lewis became the leading Christian writer of the 20th century, certainly the most influential public figure, bringing about countless conversions among intellectuals and all sorts of people as a popular voice. Tolkien, who was not so comfortable with that aspect of Lewis's legacy, more or less created the whole fantasy world that we're familiar with in various genres like gaming and so on. But, you know, Lord of the Rings is certainly the most successful work of fantasy of all time. So the two of them together are real culture makers, and the group as a whole could be seen as culture making. But in different ways, not in one monolithic way. It isn't, you know, it isn't a movement with placards and manifestos, so that their influence is a little more subtle than that, but extremely strong.
So how did the dynamic of the group change? Did it just because of old age, they stopped meeting less and sickness? Did the Inklings, I guess they are disbanded because like only one of them is alive, but did they disband because of death, or did they disband because they decided to stop seeing
Well, if you compare it to a group like the Beatles, the Inklings really, they lasted much longer and they were much better friends even while they were lasting. Nonetheless, there were, as we've said, irritants within the group, especially Hugo Dyson. Hugo Dyson got so rambunctious and complained so much about Tolkien's elves at the meetings that Tolkien stopped reading Lord of the Rings, and other members stopped reading various aspects of their work because of complaints, too many attacks and so on. So there was all that friction. Then there was the fact that they were getting older and turning in other directions. The Inklings eventually stopped as an active literary group in the 1940s, but kept late 40s, 48 or 49, I believe, and but kept up as a social group until Lewis's death in the 1960s. So they did last an awfully long time.
Yeah, I think Lewis was really the center of the group. So Lewis, towards the end of his life, in the late 40s, finally got the recognition he deserved. He was given a chair, not at Oxford, but at Cambridge. So he was commuting to Cambridge and managed to have the Tuesday morning gatherings with him, but there was no longer the Thursday evening literary workshop sort of gatherings in Lewis's rooms. So that marked a dramatic change.
I'm curious, are you all aware of any literary groups like this today, like little private groups in existence like that had the same sort of dynamic?
Well, there's an awful lot of writing groups around. You know, every time I go into Barnes & Noble, I see a group in a corner who are trying to break into print, and they share works with each other. But I doubt any of them measure up to the Inklings.
Yeah, they're probably not talking about whether dogs go to heaven.
But they're talking, well, there are definite attempts to be Inklings groups and all kinds of really self-conscious attempts to follow in that tradition. There's a writer named Diana Pavlak-Glyer who wrote a book about the collaboration among the Inklings themselves called The Company They Keep, and then most recently has a book out about literary collaboration and how wonderful it is.
Well, I'm curious. Okay, speaking of, like, you two are a husband and wife team. You wrote this book together. That's the same. Like, my wife and I, we work on the website together. We write content. I'm curious how that I'm always curious about how other husband-wife teams work together. Tell us a little about your dynamic, and maybe have you all gotten some inspiration from the Inklings on how to critique each other or help each other out with your writing?
Oh, well, with us, it's been roses all the way, so we haven't needed inspiration.
Of course. I'm sure.
However, we do have a method we use, which is, in terms of the fellowship, Carol wrote to her strengths and I wrote to mine. Without getting specific as to what each of those are, I'll say we divided the book into different sections, and then we would tackle whatever sections were assigned to each of us, and then we would exchange what we had written, and the other person would offer a critique and a rewrite, not in the Dysonian method of savage attack, but I think much more kindly and perhaps perceptively seeing what was needed. And then we would just mesh it all together. So we actually end up, we think, with a work that speaks with a single voice, but the voice of two people joined in song.
Nice analogy there. Well, Carol and Phil, where can we learn more about your work in the book?
I guess you could Google us.
That's the best thing to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Then you get to things like the Amazon page where we have both our joint and our separate books. I think there's a couple Wikipedia.
Wikipedia. Yeah.
Great. Well, Carol, Phil Zielinski, thank you so much for your time. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, pleasure for us too.
It's been fun. Thank you, Brett.
My guests today were Philip and Carol Zielinski. They're the authors of the book, The Fellowship, The Literary Lives of the Inklings. And that's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you enjoy the podcast, I'd appreciate it if you give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And as always, I appreciate your support. And until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.